The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
My name is Andrea, for those of you who have not met before. And is it on? Excellent. And for the last number of weeks, I've been talking about a particular series or list in the Buddhist tradition called the paramis, which paramis is the Pali word, which often translated as perfections or supreme qualities, something like that. And the kind of Buddhist mythology that goes with these qualities is that it's said that these are the qualities that the Buddha cultivated in the many lifetimes before he actually became the Buddha. And in fact, in the Buddhist tradition, there's this set of stories of, they're kind of like Aesop's fables. They're stories of kind of like morality tales. And these are supposed to be stories of the Buddha's former lives, and each of those kind of highlights a particular one of these qualities and how this quality was cultivated. And so that's kind of the mythology of this list. But really what the practicality of these qualities and the ten paramis are generosity, ethics, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. And this set of qualities might be understood as the set of qualities that support us to practice and to awaken. In the Burmese Buddhist tradition, these qualities are basically understood as a daily life practice. If you go to the monastery and talk to the abbot about, you know, as a lay person, if you go to the monastery and talk to the abbot about your practice, often the question will come, tell me about your paramis practice. What paramis are you cultivating in your life right now? And so they can be looked at as qualities that we can bring alive in our daily lives and to explore how do we cultivate these qualities in the midst of our everyday activities. The quality that I've been exploring, about one quality a week, and the one that I'm on this week is truthfulness. This quality, being the seventh in the list, is a deeper understanding of truthfulness than simply telling the truth or from the perspective of what we might say is wise speech. Because that one, the wise speech, was really kind of addressed in the second parami of ethics. So this one is really a deeper understanding of what it means to be truthful, what it means to be non-deceptive. The definition of truthfulness in the texts are that which has a non-deceptive nature. And so we can look at, what does it mean to be non-deceptive in our actions, non-deceptive in our speech, and non-deceptive to ourselves? This is actually a huge area for us to explore, because it goes right to the core of so many of the ways that our minds obfuscate, deceive ourselves. Not necessarily because we're trying to do that, but just kind of like the way our minds work. There are kind of functions of our mind that tend to delude us, confuse us. So I wanted to talk about this quality from this perspective of how do we begin to see the deluding nature of our own experience? How can we begin to open to, you know, there's different areas of this, just three basic areas that I'll explore around delusion. One is the most obvious or basic area of kind of just being disconnected, checked out, or not in contact with experience. That's one form of delusion. But then at another level is delusions that come from beliefs or views or ideas or opinions that we have that we don't see are beliefs or views or opinions or ideas. We are behaving as though it's truth. And that's a form of delusion or denial in a way, that we're not aware that we're relating to experience through these views, beliefs, ideas, opinions, and we're just relating to it as if it were true. And so this is a huge way that we, while not, I mean, it's not the disconnection from experience, we can be fully connected with what's going on in the world and yet perceiving it. You know, you see this with people having conversations. You know, one person is looking at it from one perspective and another person's looking at it from another perspective. Sometimes the language they're using is just not even connecting, because each person has their own perspective, their own views, their own understandings. And so this can get us into trouble. It can get us into trouble when we think we're communicating, but we're not. So that's a second form of delusion. And a third form of delusion is at an even deeper level, what I might call human delusion. You know, just the tendency that we have as human beings to impute permanence to what is impermanent, to impute reliability to something that might not be so reliable, and to impute controllability to something that is not so controllable. And so these are areas of exploration. The first one is that disconnection from experience. The second two, you can be fully aware of what's happening and yet seeing through a filter, seeing through a belief or an idea or some kind of perspective that basically has us take in certain information and not other information. And so we're not fully receiving the world. It's not things as they actually are. And this word, yata bhuta in the Pali, translated as things as they actually are, is this area of truth, of truthfulness. What we explore is the possibility of actually being present for things as they actually are, not as we want them to be, but as they actually are, or not as we believe them to be, but as they actually are. And so this is an area that's hard to see. It's very hard to see because we're seeing from our perspective. And yet there's some information that I can offer that may help you to begin to see ways and tools that may help you begin to explore perspectives and views and beliefs that are present that we may not be so aware of. And so that's kind of the perspective I'd like to explore about truth this evening. But first I'd like to put it in the frame of this list of the paramis, because as I've been talking about each week, one of the reasons they're called the perfections is not only because they are qualities that are cultivated and strengthened and perfected as we practice, but it is said that each one of them in this list, and kind of a directional list, each one of them supports the cultivation of the next. So patience is the quality that comes right before truthfulness. Patience supports the ability of our mind to begin to see through these delusive, deceptive aspects of our mind. It takes patience because it is so hard to see. And so it is said then that the subsequent quality, in this case truthfulness, perfects patience. So that, as I talked about around patience, initially we may have to be patient or explore what it means to cultivate patience. But as we more and more land with the truth of things as they actually are, patience becomes more natural. Patience becomes the more we understand, the more we recognize the nature of experience as being what it is, as being impermanent, as being unreliable and out of control, the more the mind comes into alignment with that truth. As we come into alignment with those truths, the mind naturally begins to be much more at ease. And that's that quality of patience that becomes perfected, because it's no longer fighting against what's here. It's just naturally aligned with what's here. And so as we open to this exploration of truth, patience strengthens. And the quality that follows truthfulness is resolve or determination. And my understanding of this is that as we begin to get a taste of the truth, as we begin to actually start to recognize, wow, this mind is so deluded. This mind, it confuses itself. This mind has beliefs and views and opinions that it doesn't even notice. As it begins to see what our minds are doing, there becomes a kind of determination to start to see through it. So that a little taste of this perspective of truth adds to our inspiration and our aspiration to engage with the practice, to engage with the teachings. And as we engage, as we actually practice, the deepening of the understanding of truth happens. And so the determination to keep digging, it's kind of like, as we practice, it's like we see little bits. It's like layers and layers and layers are uncovered. And in a moment, we may see a little bit of confusion, such as how we might recognize, as one example of this kind of delusion, that when we want something, the wanting to have something, you know, that we think we want the thing, we think we want the pleasant thing. And yet, as we begin to explore that experience, and this is the whole of our practice, to enter into what's actually happening in this moment. And so what's happening in this moment is that wanting is happening, and the encouragement is to look at, okay, well, what does wanting feel like? What's that dynamic? What is that experience? And so we explore, what does wanting feel like? And we discover that wanting has a feeling of offness to it. Already, as soon as we want something, there's a feeling of lack. It's not necessarily about the thing that we want that we experience that lack, but the wanting itself creates an experience of lack. We think wanting is telling us that in order to be happy, we have to have that thing. And we believe that. We believe it very thoroughly when we're caught in the throes of that wanting. We're caught by the story of that wanting. We thoroughly believe that having that thing is going to make us happy. We know perhaps that it'll only make us happy for a little while, but there's some way in which we really buy into that. That's what's going to make me happy. And then we get the thing, perhaps, maybe we get the thing, and we do feel some measure of happiness. We feel a little bit of happiness from having that thing, And we also, and this is the part that we don't usually experience or see directly, it happens under the surface. We also, as we get the thing, we get the experience or the, for a few moments, that experience of wanting goes away. And so the feeling of lack goes away. And so not only when we get the thing that we want do we have the pleasure of the having, we have the pleasure of the ending of the wanting. And that that dynamic, you know, as we start to watch and actually see what's going on around wanting, if we explore the wanting itself without, in a small way maybe, I explored this so many times in my practice in small ways, like, you know, not acting on getting a cup of a cappuccino, or not acting on having a piece of chocolate, or not acting on looking at somebody when I wanted to while I was on retreat, and just watching the dynamic of wanting. And in watching it, seeing that wanting doesn't last forever, even if we don't get the thing. Sometimes seeing directly in the moment the wanting vanishing and recognizing, whew, wow, that felt like being released from a vice grip. And deeply understanding in that moment that the key piece of the unhappiness or the feeling of a problem around wanting is the wanting itself. It's not the not having. And so the delusion of wanting, the delusion that is embedded in wanting, is that if I get that thing, I'll be happy. The wanting itself is the kind of pull towards the pleasant. But the delusion that's embedded in there is that getting that's going to make me happy. Wanting, when you're caught in it, is not going to tell you, oh, by the way, if wanting goes away, it won't be a problem. That is the delusion of wanting. It so buys into its perspective that I have to have that thing, that it can't see any other way. So these kinds of delusions, you know, we see little things like that maybe. We maybe see the perspective of wanting itself having a delusive nature to it. And a little light goes on there. And as we see that little insight or that little recognition, it increases the determination for continuing to see, because we see a different way towards happiness than we had previously. We hadn't really thought it was possible. Our whole orientation towards happiness so much has to do with getting things that we want and getting rid of things that we don't want. Organizing our lives to have the things, pleasant things around us and get rid of unpleasant things. So much of our perspective on happiness comes from that. And yet the beginning of really begin to see into the truth is seeing the possibility of happiness that comes as we explore letting go of needing to arrange, needing to control, needing to fix, needing to have, needing to get rid of, and see what happens as we explore a different perspective. So the determination that comes as we begin to touch into little bits of this truth. And it's kind of like a dive. We dive into our habits and our patterns and the ways that we believe things to function in the world. And we begin to peel back the layers, peel back the perspectives to show us that there's something else that's possible. And that gives us the strength and the interest to continue to perfect the truth so that we clearly can begin to see things as they actually are again, not as we want them to be, or not as wanting wants them to be, or not as aversion wants them to be. So looking at truthfulness, looking at what is this? What are we not seeing here? It's so hard. It's so hard to see what we're not seeing. So let's explore these various layers that I mentioned, the first one being kind of the disconnection. This one is, as I said, the most obvious, and usually we notice this one kind of in the moment when we remember about mindfulness again. You know, we've been lost. We've been lost in thought. Being lost in thought, kind of caught in our world of fantasies and ideas and memories and beliefs, when our minds are telling ourselves the story of me and the story of other, that is a form of delusion, partly because we are just not here. We are lost in a world of ideas, of thoughts. And how thoroughly, it's amazing actually, how thoroughly our mind can believe its creation of thought. At one point, I was getting over a relationship and had actually gotten over it quite a bit. There wasn't so much in the way of reactive emotion around it. And yet one day, as I was walking down the street, it was like a couple years after this particular relationship had ended, but my mind had gone into this story, into this memory, or I don't know, it was just some kind of construction where it had decided to think about being in relationship with that person again. You know, this relationship was 2 years gone. And fortunately, because I had let go of so much of the reactive emotions around it, when I came out of that thought, I wasn't immediately kind of overwhelmed by, oh, I'm not in that relationship. It's, oh, poor me. Oh, I'm so, why me? And I'm never going to be happy again. That didn't happen. But what did happen was that it was so clearly revealed how thoroughly the mind had believed it was in relationship again. It was like, pop, that illusion, that set of thoughts disappeared. And I'm walking down the street and it's like, what? Wait a minute. I'm not in relationship with that person. What? What's going on? So there was confusion because the mind had so thoroughly believed that story. It's stunning, actually, how often we do this. Our minds create an idea, believe it, and then react to it or respond to it. Another example of that around this same relationship, but when I was in relationship with that person, was that I would have ideas. I would construct ideas about things that person might do. I would tell a story in my mind, he might do this or that or the other thing. And they were things that were in the terrain of things that he had done or might have done. But they were complete constructions, you know, so there was just this idea of, oh, he might do that, or what if he does that? And I would, you know, get lost in that thought, and I'd wake up and I'd be really angry. I'd be really angry at him for this thing that I thought that he might do. And it was like, it was a complete construction of my mind. So this is one of the dangers of that delusive, you know, the being disconnected, not actually here. We are kind of at the mercy of the stories that we're telling our minds. Our minds are telling, the stories that our minds are telling. And often they have very little relationship to reality. Another example about this from my own life is that I was definitely a planner. I wanted to kind of think through all possible outcomes. And so this is, again, it's a form of getting lost in thought, being disconnected from actual experience. But it's a function our minds have to plan. But I would notice that my mind would go, okay, well, what if this happens, then I'll do this and this and this. If that happens, then I'll do this and this and this. And I would like create plans for the 17 possible outcomes that I could conceive of, all, you know, in my mind. And And what I would often discover is that by the time that the situation came around, first of all, vast majority of the time, none of those situations played out. None of those 17 or 25 situations actually happened. And so all of that planning was really a waste of time. And yet, if one of them did actually happen, you know, I kind of had foreseen, oh yeah, that might happen. The plan that I'd created about, well, this is how I'll respond and this is what I'll do, almost never could I do it. Because conditions were present in the moment that I couldn't have foreseen. Conditions of how I was in the moment or how somebody else was in the situation. And so the plans that I had made about that situation were basically useless. I spent so much time in that kind of mode. And what I have seen in my life and in my practice is that the best preparation that I can do for any possible outcome is to be non-deluded here and now, is to actually meet this moment, to cultivate the capacity to be present in this moment, because cultivating the capacity to be present in this moment means that I'm more likely to be present in subsequent moments. And when I can be present in this moment, I have access to so much more balance of mind and wisdom and compassion and generosity of heart and open-hearted quality. And when I cultivate that in this moment, it makes it much more likely that that will be what's possible in the future. And so this is this area of cultivating just being connected, this area of the delusion of being disconnected. So this is the easiest one to see, and perhaps the easiest one to begin to, you know, those moments of waking up, just reminding yourself, oh, right, I'm present now. This is what it's like to be present, beginning to recognize the difference between being present and being lost in thought. We can know that difference. It's not that we really know the being lost in thought while we're lost in thought, but as we come out of it, there's a memory of what it was like to be lost in thought. It's like this feeling of being folded in on yourself, not, you know, just kind of separated from the world. And that contrasts with landing here, being here. Second kind of delusion is this delusion around views or opinions or beliefs. Often this comes in relationship to concepts. We're relating to experience through a concept or with an idea in mind, and don't really know that we're relating to experience through an idea or a concept. So this one's harder to see because we're present. This may be one where we're not lost in thought, but we're actually connected with experience. But we're not seeing that we're seeing our experience from the perspective of an idea. Well, this is a form of delusion. We're not seeing things as they actually are. We're seeing them as we believe them to be. So at least one example I'll give about this. This example comes from a time when I was in Burma practicing in the monastery, and there's a lot of noise in Burma, and the monastery was not too far from a village, and some of the noises from the village kind of came over the monastery walls, the loudspeakers and sounds from the village. And one evening I began recognizing or hearing at a particular time of the evening a squealing noise that was happening. And to me, this squealing sounded like a pig. So that's how I perceived this experience. The squealing was a pig. And because I knew there was a village nearby, and because to me it sounded like this squealing pig was in distress, I created the story, and I could see it was a story. I created the story that there was a butcher shop on the other side of the wall, and the squealing I was hearing regularly each evening at about the same time was the butcher slaughtering the pig to sell. So that was my story, and it created an emotional response to the squealing, which was compassion. I mean, I felt the pain of this being that I thought was dying, being killed, and so every evening for days, this was the response. I would hear the squealing, and I would feel this compassion. And I was just practicing with it. And I did know that, I did not really know there was a butcher shop on the other side, but at the same time, that was how I was perceiving the situation. And then one evening, instead of meditating in my room at that time of day, I decided I'd take a walk, and I was walking out. It was, you know, dusk. And as I was walking, I began seeing these bats swooshing by, and they were squealing. And I realized that the squealing sound that I'd been hearing had not even been a pig. It had been these bats. Of course, you know, there was no need for compassion at that moment. The story completely vanished. And I could really see in that moment just how much, even though I knew in my mind, yeah, I don't really know, there's a butcher shop over there, just how much I had believed that story. Just how much I had bought into it, even as I was being mindful, even as I was being very present. I did not see this filter of belief of pig being slaughtered really as a belief. So this kind of thing, where we are relating to experience through a view, through an idea, through belief, through opinion, through agenda even. Even a simple agenda can have an impact on what we take in and what we don't take in. So we do this all the time. It's quite humbling as we start to see in our minds just how much beliefs and views and opinions and agendas are operating, concepts are operating, and how hard it is to recognize that concepts and views and beliefs are operating. And so an exploration here, in particular if there's suffering, might be to begin to be curious about, well, what beliefs are happening right now? What am I believing right now? What is the view that's happening right now? Now, there's so much suffering in the world that comes from this kind of perspective. I mean, the whole field of implicit bias around racism right now is really looking at this area of, you know, the perspectives, the views, the hidden beliefs that are operating, the hidden associations, the connections that have been made through conditioning in our lives that influence how we relate to people along the lines of so many of the isms of racism, of heterosexual homophobia, I mean, all of the different kinds of ways that we see somebody not for who they are, but through our ideas, through the kind of baggage we carry along, or through the conditioning that we've had. And so this is a huge area of exploration for us to begin to question our perspectives. One little tool around this for myself that I read in a book recently, great book around a lot of these topics around racism and diversity and beginning to see some of these implicit biases that we have. The book is called Deep Diversity by Shaquille Choudhury. And he points to a question that we can ask as we come into contact with some of our own habitual reactions around race or homophobia or sexism, ageism, whatever. And a question that he encourages as you meet somebody individually is to recognize that you may be seeing that person through a group lens, a lens of ideas or views or a collection of beliefs around that person, rather than actually meeting that person. And the question, he says, you can just drop this into your mind. I found it to be a fun question, and it just kind of breaks through some of those beliefs or those habits that we carry. And the question is, I wonder what kind of vegetables that person likes. You know, it adds a little bit of curiosity, and it brings it into the humanity of a person who likes vegetables or doesn't like certain vegetables. I found this to be a really, well, fun and useful tool for kind of like popping the bubble of those views. So this area of, you know, carrying views, carrying opinions is a huge area of delusion. We do not generally meet the world as it actually is. We're meeting it through these lenses of our beliefs and our ideas. In one place in the texts, the Buddha is asked, well, how do you preserve truth? And the Buddha said, well, when you believe something, you preserve truth by saying, this is what I believe, rather than saying, this is what is true. And so it begins to highlight for us this question of what are we believing? And to actually name it. Yes, this is belief. As we name beliefs as beliefs. And this is equally applying to ourselves as to others. I saw this for myself around self-hatred. The whole pattern of self-hatred was constructed of so many beliefs. That I was a failure, that I was no good, that I was somehow inherently flawed. And exposing and recognizing, oh, believing I'm no good is what's happening. That's actually, it's kind of aligning with what's going on in the mind, and that it's believing that it's, you know, the belief that I'm no good is happening in this moment. And yet, it opens the door a little bit for us to recognize, right, it's a belief. It's not necessarily the truth. So that practice for me was helpful around looking at my own, ways to begin to look at my own self-beliefs. We box other people into boxes based on our beliefs about them, and we box ourselves up too based on beliefs about ourselves. And so what are our beliefs? What are we believing? What do we believe we're capable of? What do we believe we're limited by? And begin to recognize it's belief. The third area is the third kind of delusion is kind of the most insidious kind of delusion because it is like embedded in our the ways that we meet the world, that's embedded in being human in effect almost, that we take what is impermanent to be permanent. We take what is unreliable to be reliable. We take what is uncontrollable to be controllable. And so these are This could be it. This could be a long talk. I'm just going to kind of do a little hand-waving about this right now. A way I'd suggest exploring this is beginning to be curious of whether and when you are taking something to be permanent, reliable, and controllable. And begin to look at whether that's actually the case or not. Now there are, it's a paradox. I mean, the uncontrollable one is, it's kind of a paradox because, you know, there are ways in which we can make choices and do things and have impacts on the world. I mean, I can decide I'm going to pick up this glass of water and take a drink. I mean, it seems like I have control over that. So, you know, so it's a little confusing what it means, what actually uncontrollability means. But essentially, it's related to that while we have some say in our choice in this moment, you know, we can choose in this moment to act in a certain way. Like I might choose to say something to somebody with the intention of supporting them, of offering them some kind of help or something. And so the heart of you know, my intention being one of generosity and kindness, and yet I don't have control over how it's going to be received. I don't have control over the outcome. And so we have some measure of control in how we act and some measure of choice in acting, hopefully in ways that are kind and generous and not tied up with hatred and aversion. We can maybe begin to choose to act out of non-greed, non-aversion. And yet we can't control how that lands. We can't control how it's going to be received. We can't control all the ripple effects that follow from that. And that is something that we have to recognize as a truth. You know, sometimes we feel like if things don't turn out the way we want them to, that I just didn't try hard enough, or I didn't do the right thing somehow. And, you know, sometimes we just don't have control over the outcome. This, I think, comes up a lot in relationships between parents and children, the whole question of, you know, really wanting to have your children make choices that are in their own best interest, and yet recognizing at some point that they have to make their own choices, that their choices are not in your control. It's so challenging to begin to let that go. So there's so many areas of of places where we wish we had control that we don't have control and we suffer over them. And this is how I would encourage the exploration around when we take things to be permanent, when we take things to be reliable, when we take things to be controllable. Are we suffering around those imputations? Like, I thought this was going to be the thing that was going to make me happy. I thought this relationship was going to be reliable. I thought this person would never leave me. And we suffer. I mean, of course we suffer from the loss and the pain of loss, but there's also sometimes we have a suffering around the I did something wrong because, you know, I thought this was reliable and it's not reliable. Or that person did something wrong. They're to blame because they're not reliable. As opposed to understanding unreliability is a truth. impermanence is a truth, and uncontrollability is a truth. These are kind of some of the core truths that this parami of truthfulness is pointing to. That we begin to recognize that we suffer when we are not in alignment with these truths. And so when we are suffering, usually there's some way in which we are at odds with one of these truths. We're fighting one of these truths. We're wanting reliability. We're wanting permanence. We're wanting controllability. Now there's a kind of a stretching of the heart that happens here. You know, if we just look from the perspective of truth, we might kind of begin to close down because, you know, the heart of love wants to be safe, wants to be happy, wants to be healthy, and wants to live with ease. These are the fundamental wishes of love, of metta, of loving kindness. And it seems, on the surface of it, that those wishes, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I be safe, that those wishes are in inherent conflict with the truths of unreliable, impermanent, out of control. Like we want to be safe, we want to be healthy, and we get injured. A partner gets a diagnosis of cancer. You know, it's the truth is hard to reconcile with these wishes. And yet, sometimes I think what I hear happening is people beginning to try to use the wisdom. It's like, well, okay, it's unreliable. I've got this diagnosis of cancer, and I just have to accept that life is unreliable and it's out of control. And I hear a kind of a repression of that wish for happiness and well-being. And so there's this kind of paradoxical exploration of holding both the wish and the truth, where these two come into conflict is in the demand. You know, the wish itself for safety, for health, is a wholesome wish. And the wish to control our experience so that I be healthy, be safe, that's kind of, we clamp down in fear around that or in anger around that, especially when we see that it's impermanent and unreliable and out of control. It's like the truth of the way things are and this wish of metta, it's like they're fighting with each other. And often this is where our suffering happens, when our wishes and these truths collide and we react out of anger and aversion and fear, hostility, confusion, frustration. And yet paradoxically, the pain is coming from that reactivity, the collision, not from the truth or the wishes. There's a way in which the heart can expand and hold both. Yes, I want to be happy. And things are unreliable. It's a kind of a slippery place to be there. And yet, the heart, when it can hold both, it's like it stops being so constricted. It stops fighting the truth. And yet, as it stops fighting the truth and is not constricted, it also deeply opens to love and compassion. It seems like such a paradox. And yet these two are not contradictory. And so I really wanted to bring that in, because sometimes as we talk about non-delusion and talk about these truths, it seems so harsh, or it seems so unconnected to love. And yet, if we have the courage to not repress the wishes for love, we'll find that the heart can even open even more to the truth and be more elastic, more flexible. At one point, I recognized this connection between the reactivity and the deep wish. I was in a state of fear around a particular situation, and in that moment, it was a fear, and it felt like there was danger. I felt like there was danger in the situation, and so, you know, there was sort of that sense of things are unreliable here. You know, this is unreliable situation. It is out of control. I do not have control over this situation. And yet, and so there's a lot of fear that kind of was reacting to that. But as I recognized the fear and began kind of following the thread, you know, when we have some kind of reactivity like this, we can follow the threads back to both the truth of, yep, it's out of control and it's unreliable, and back to the wish for safety. And as I kind of touched into that fear and recognized in a moment there was a spontaneous wish, may all beings be safe. And my heart landed so fully in that, yes, that is what I want. May all beings be safe. And it could somehow hold that. And I could see that the fear was grounded in that wish. It was kind of like connected to that wish, but it was twisted. It was twisted by the feeling that somehow, I mean, basically the mind says when it's reacting in that way, when these two conflict, it's either saying the truth is wrong, it should be reliable, it should be controllable, or it's saying this wish is wrong, I shouldn't want for everybody to be safe. And the paradox is we can open to both of those. It can be unreliable and we can wish for well-being for all beings and for ourselves. And so this alignment with the truth, when we don't repress the side of love, actually lets us stretch to cultivate both wisdom and compassion together. Because we see that it's not just us, you know, it's not just us subject to these truths. And it's not just us that wants to be happy. There's something about seeing that deeply that we see, yeah, this is everybody. Everybody wants this. Everybody wants to be happy, and everybody struggles with these truths. And so our hearts expand beyond our limited perspective of just I, me, and mine, and recognize, yeah, this is a human condition. And we can stop being so kind of narrowly focused around it and begin to be curious about how might I be able to open to both the truth and love. And the way, as I said, the way to that is through the meeting of the reaction. mindfulness of that reaction, not to push it away, oh, fear is happening, not to say, oh, I should either, you know, feel, you know, the love for all beings, or I should, you know, acknowledge this is uncontrollable, but no, fear is what's happening. Can I open to that? Can I open to that? And in that process, you know, I used to believe, actually, when I met some kind of suffering, like the self-hatred, for instance, you know, at one point I kind of felt like, you know, this thing is wholly bad. If I could just take a scalpel and cut that out of my mind and throw it away, that would be better. But what I understand now is that we can't do that, because those patterns are intimately connected with these truths and these wishes. And what we have to do is allow the mindfulness to begin to kind of melt and massage the reactivity. And it begins to point the way back to these truths and these wishes. And so this is our work in practice. The exploration of truth. Truth means, can I be with this? Whatever it is in this moment. And I talked the whole time again, so we have to stop. Thank you for your attention.